Well, here we are on the Bluebell Railway in Sussex, and the sounds you can hear of the engine, the carriage, the whistle would all be familiar to Andrew Martin's hero, Jim Stringer, even though he lived a century ago. Jim's base was York, so we're not exactly on his home turf, but he would recognise the atmosphere here at the Bluebell with its preserved stations and many other Victorian and Edwardian railway features. So, Andrew, for those who haven't heard of Jim Stringer, just give us a sketch of what kind of man he was and how he came to be a railway detective.
Well, at the start of the series of books, he's a late teenager, very interested in railways. He takes the railway magazine on subscription every month. And I should add that there's nothing remotely uncool about being interested in trains in the late 19th century or the early 20th century. The term train spotters, which is a disparaging term, hadn't yet come in. They were known rather respectfully as train watchers, or railwayists, perhaps, slightly satirical. Jim is one of those, and he's interested in speed, high speed, which was a new coinage of the time. And trains were, they were sexy in the modern parlance. So he's an ambitious young man. He wants to be a train driver.
Where was he born? Where did he grow up?
He grows up in... he's born in what he calls Baytown, which is Robin Hood's Bay, in Yorkshire, in North Yorkshire. And that had its railway station at the time. The station is still there, and I think it's a private house now. A particularly spectacular railway line going across the cliff tops. And he grows up watching these trains, mesmerised by them, and he wants to make his living from working in the railways. So he gets his start, as he calls it, on the North Eastern Railway, but unfortunately only as a porter, and he doesn't really want to be a porter, he wants to be a driver. And one day a mysterious man comes along in the first of the novels, which is called The Necropolis Railway, and he says, wouldn't you like to come down to London and work on the London and South Western Railway? You could start as a cleaner.
Cleaning the engines, that was, wasn't
cleaning
it?
Cleaning the engines. And Jim jumps at the chance. What he doesn't realise is that he's being lured into working on the most sinister aspect of the London and South Western Railway's operations, which was carrying the dead bodies down to Brookwood Cemetery from the Necropolis station outside Waterloo.
But the Necropolis Railway wasn't your fictional invention. That was actually a real railway. That's what people did. People died in London and they were buried out in the countryside because there weren't enough cemeteries in London.
The Necropolis Railway sounds like a project invented by a fiction writer. In fact, it was a real business enterprise. It was a railway line that carried people from London to the biggest cemetery in the world, Brookwood Cemetery, in Surrey. The idea was that everyone, literally everyone, who died in London would be carried on the railway line down to the cemetery. There would be a city of the living, i.e. London, and a city of the dead, the Necropolis. And so the railway that carried the bodies down could expect to do very well. Of course, it didn't work out quite like that, because permission was given to build more cemeteries within London, such as Highgate Cemetery, cemeteries in the suburbs of London. And these cured the problem of where to bury people in London. So the Necropolis became a bit of an irrelevance, and the Necropolis railway line actually never became very busy. Also, later on, people began to be cremated, and you wouldn't need to be carried down to the Necropolis in Brookwood in order to be cremated.
So Jim ends up coming down from Yorkshire and working on this line. What happens to him then?
He works on the line which had its locomotives and rolling stock supplied from the Nine Elms engine shed of the London and South Western Railway. So he's based in South London. He lives near Waterloo, in amongst all the high-level lines coming into the station, and he gradually discovers that his special area of operations is going to be the line down to the Brookwood Cemetery. And there's something peculiar about that line. I mean, even more peculiar than you might think from the actual business model, which is carrying dead bodies. There's something even more sinister going on, which he only gradually finds out about. So here's a young man. His ambition is to be driving 100-mile-an-hour locomotives. He ends up on this peculiar little line which carried its carriages through the cemetery at less than 10 miles an hour, stopping at one station for the Church of England bodies, one for the nonconformists. I think there was one for Catholics as well.
And did they have more than one body on the same train?
The train would go down with as many bodies as they could get onto it, and you could go, your corpse could go first, second or third class, I believe, just as the mourners could as well. In practice, the line also carried a lot of golfers down to the area around Brookwood in Surrey, because there are a lot of golf courses around there.
We're just going into a tunnel now. It must have been quite spooky going to Brookwood on the Necropolis Railway and going through a tunnel.
I think a train full of dead bodies, a dark afternoon, pelting down with rain. That's would be creepy enough for most people, I think. Yes.
And in that first book, does Jim actually solve the murder? Is that the thing that sets him on the path to becoming a detective?
He does come up against a murder. It is a murder story, and he sort of solves it, yes. And his next adventure is also as an ordinary railway man. That's called the Blackpool High Flyer. And again, he's very unlucky in this way. He comes up against a murderer. But thereafter, Jim joins the railway police. So from the third novel in the series, The Lost Luggage Porter, he is employed as a railway policeman in York. He made the mistake of running, whilst a fireman, of running a locomotive through the back wall of an engine shed. So his ambition is sacked. And his ambition to be steam train driver is never to be fulfilled. He's sidelined into the railway police.
From my reading of the books, he's always a bit of a frustrated man.
Never entirely happy about being a railway policeman because he wants to be a driver. In that sense, he always is young at heart. He remains clings on to that rather naive ambition. And I think he never rules out the possibility that it might happen. His wife, who is very sceptical about the railways and very sceptical about Jim as well, in a way, takes the mickey out of him. She can't believe a man of 30, as he becomes in the later books, still seriously wants to be an engine driver.
Where does his wife come from?
His wife is from London. She's perhaps a bit sharper than Jim. She's a feminist. A suffragette, as the Daily Mail dubbed them. And she doesn't like trains. They're dirty. Keep Jim away from the house at all hours. She'd rather he was in a proper white-collar job. She'd like him to be a solicitor, actually, rather than a railway detective.
So he goes to Blackpool in novel number two. Where else in the country does he find himself?
Well, these books have been an opportunity to take him all over the country, really. Although he becomes based in the north, in York, he travels widely. I mean, that's why they're set on the railways, really. And they're a chance to show people who live in towns like, say, Middlesbrough or Scarborough in the latest novel, or Halifax or Blackpool, what their towns were like 100 years ago. In fact, in many cases, those towns, of course, were better 100 years ago, not to put too fine a point on it.
Now, did you set out in the very beginning, had you got all this worked out, the period and the process of Jim's life? Because I've read all of the novels now, and we start about 1900, and in this last book, The Last Train to Scarborough, we're in 1914, on the eve of the First World War. In fact, you talk about what's now the North Sea, but it was called the German Sea in those days. When you started inventing Jim, had you got this line of development all worked out in your head at the very beginning?
Not entirely, but the first book sold quite well, or at least quite well by my standards, and so my publishers said, why don't you try another one? And it only gradually became a series. With the Sherlock Holmes stories, you don't see Sherlock Holmes ageing, do you? You never really know what age he is at any particular point. But I thought it would be interesting to have Jim grow up, and I always thought that he would end up having to fight in the First World War. And the whole of the Edwardian period exists in the shadow of the First World War. You're always very aware of it looming. It's very poignant to look at pictures of young men taken, perhaps railway men, taken in 1910. You think, well, what happened to them 4 years later? Half of them would have had their heads blown off. And so I felt that it was logical it would lead up to the First World War, and I will be taking Jim off to the Western Front in the next novel in the series. The North Eastern Railway Company, which is his employer, sent a whole battalion of men to the Western Front. It was the only private company to raise a battalion. They went there to operate railways on the Western Front.
In this latest novel, The Last Train to Scarborough, what I like about it is the fact that, for me, it's got Yorkshire in it, which is where I come from. It's got trains in it. But it's got this rather sinister bed and breakfast establishment, which is kind of what I slightly remember from my youth, going to the seaside. And it's sinister in a sort of Hitchcock sort of way. You never quite know where the murder's going to be. The characters in it are a bit odd, really. Was that in your head when you started out?
I spent a lot of time in Scarborough in the off-season. I just like it. I prefer it in the off-season. And the sheer wildness of the place. I mean, the size of the waves, the darkness, the flying rain. I mean, it's to me, it's very beautiful. And I thought, let's take Scarborough in the off-season in early 1914. Who would have been there? Who would have been washed up there in the off-season? And so I came up with half a dozen characters who are all, I suppose you might call them, shabby genteel, and put them in a boarding house directly overlooking the sea. It's an exercise in atmosphere, really. This boarding house takes in railway men. You know, it'll put them up if they have to overnight in Scarborough, and this was a common phenomenon at the time. The trouble is that one railway man never emerges from this house, and Jim is sent to investigate. He's instructed to spend a night in the house and see if he can find out what happened to this previous railway man. The question, of course, is will Jim emerge from the Paradise Guest House, or will he too disappear? This is the most violent of the books, and I think it's the oddest. I really got to know those people in that boarding house, and it's only really peripherally a railway story. It's more of a horror story.
You know, I said at the beginning we're not exactly on his home turf, but actually he does take a trip to the south coast in the last train to Scarborough, and perhaps he did travel on this line through the middle of Sussex.
Now you pointed it out, I think he would have done, yes. I admit that I just put him on a train at Victoria at a certain crucial plot point and headed him down to Eastbourne. But yes, it's possible that he would have come through the Blue Bell. Certainly looking out the window now, I can see things that I can imagine Jim seeing. We've just passed a wagon, steam banana van. I mean, isn't that a beautiful conjunction? These carriages over here, mysterious, blank-faced carriages for some industrial purpose. I don't know what they would have been, mail-sorting vans or something. I mean, there's more charm in the view from this window than there is in the view from almost any window on the actual modern railway that I can think of. I mean, here we are in a compartment. Compartments are so, have so much potential for drama. You know, you can stretch out and go to sleep, or you could be in a very intense encounter with a person sitting 2 feet opposite you in the absolute privacy of this enclosed space. And what's appealing to me about the period is the quite subtle differences. For example, just to look at a town and have smoke coming out of every chimney, to have a man take his hat off when he walked past a woman. Every man would have a moustache or a beard. It's little things like that that I find fascinating.
Why was it that you decided to combine the idea of railways and murder fiction?
Atmosphere is very important in crime fiction, and the railways is it's the most atmospheric area of life, or at least it was in the days of steam. I mean, every engine carried its own literal atmosphere with it. Film directors have exploited this many times, not least in Brief Encounter, where David Lean urged the drivers of the engines passing through the station to let rip, meaning to let out as much steam as possible. The Victorians were very keen on atmosphere, very keen on rail fires, very keen on steam, smoke. I mean, they liked it, even though it was natural life for them. They appreciated it. The Impressionists came from France to paint our atmosphere, our pollution, I should say, really. But there was a kind of beauty about it. So in that sense, the railways are made for crime fiction, I think.
But there were real murders on the railway, weren't there? I mean, I think the first one was in the 1840s in London when somebody was kind of thrown out of a carriage onto an embankment. And early travellers were quite scared of getting in these closed compartments with what they thought might be lunatics.
There weren't as many murders on the railways as you might think. In fact, I read that there had been about six between about 1890 and 1914. Well, there were more than six in my books between those periods. But the railways generally did unnerve people. The speed of them was unnerving, and the mixing with complete strangers. And there was a whole genre of fiction to do with meeting odd, mustachioed, caddish men on trains. You know, they did things like there'd be a lady sitting alone in a compartment, then a man would climb down from the carriage roof and clamber in through the window with a perfunctory "excuse me," you know, but what was he up to? So there were a lot of crime railway novels of the time sold on the station bookstalls to try and exploit the excitement and also the fear that the railways generated. I think railway men are, as a general rule, a very rectitudinous bunch. It's interesting when one of them goes astray because, of course, they are in positions of power and trust. And I think there is also a slightly sinister element to railway men in the sense that they're often alone in remote areas. Signal men are very interesting, and Dickens exploited this in his ghost story, The Signal Man. They spend hours on their own, and of course they have the responsibility for hundreds of lives every day. They would read a lot, and Dickens' signalman practices fractions and learns a language. Strange inward figures, but they have to be very intelligent as well because the job is so responsible. I think engine drivers were a bit like that. They were a bit cowboyish, flinty-looking, silent men, tough but also reflective. An interesting breed of man, I think, worked on the...
Living on the edge.
Yes, I think a lot of responsibility for other people, physically brave, a liking for high speed. You know, I think all steam engine drivers should look a bit like Clint Eastwood, and a lot of them actually did, kind of windburned.
How do you do the research? Do you steep yourself in railway history all the time?
Well, I don't know as much railway history as I probably should. I certainly read a lot of novels of the time, and almost any novel of the Edwardian period will have lots of trains in it because people went everywhere by train. So in that sense, the research is done accidentally. I don't read that much technical stuff about railways, but I do look at back numbers of the railway magazine, just as Jim would have done, so I can read exactly the kind of publications that he would have been reading. And any station bookstall at the time would have been absolutely bedecked with railway magazines.
And the stations were much more populated than they are now. Kind of all of human life was there.
The railway station really was what the advocates of modern high-speed railways want railway stations to become again. They were a community hub. The whole idea of cheap bookstalls, that came from station bookstalls. Cheap restaurants, that came from station buffets. You could go there for a drink, you could go there for a smoke, you could go there to use the lavatory. They were full of people not necessarily getting on trains. And, of course, they were often enormous and very beautiful and filled with steam and smoke.
And another aspect of this last novel is the kind of email of the day. Postcards feature quite prominently, although I must say they're rather dubious postcards.
Well, they're racy postcards, yes. The point about communications at the time is that, really half the plots in my novels couldn't exist if Jim Stringer was only equipped with a mobile phone. Because often the whole crux of the matter is getting crucial information to somebody, possibly life or death, within a very short amount of time. But Jim, of course, can't do that. He has to send a telegram. And so how does he do that? He's got to walk to a post office, he's got to know the correct telegraphic address, he's got to have the right money, maybe. How much money is it? 2 shillings and 6 pence? It's all very labour-intensive. Jim Stringer spends a lot of time frustrated, walking, cycling, trying to get over this problem of poor communications. And I hope that the reader is reading it and thinking, well, I'm very lucky to have this mobile phone in my pocket.
But tell us more about those postcards.
Well, I don't know how much we can say on a family radio station. There's a seedy character in the guest house in Scarborough who trades in pornographic postcards, for which there was a fashion at the time. They would normally be not sent openly through the post, but sent in envelopes or just collected and hoarded by a certain type of gentleman. And so this is a subplot of the latest novel. Postcards generally were very popular. I mean, they were postcards for everything. I did a novel set in Middlesbrough to do with the vast ironworks on the banks of the Tees. If a man went to Middlesbrough, he'd buy a postcard showing the ironworks and send it to his girlfriend, you know. Postcards for everything.
And there was post, what, 3 or 4 times a day in some places?
There was much more post. Yes, people would write. I think you could write a letter to someone and have a reply within the same day. It was like email.
Would you have liked to have lived in the time of Jim Stringer?
Well, I probably would be dead if I had done, because I had quite a serious operation which saved my life when I was 1 year old. I mean, I have a great romantic attachment to the Edwardian era. First of all, men were very much better dressed. Men digging holes in the road, and certainly working on the railways, would do so in a dark suit, with a waistcoat and a tie, or at least some kind of neckerchief. If you looked at those Mitchell and Kenyon archive, sort of home movie films of Edwardians, which was shown on TV a few months ago, I was struck by how elegant everyone was. Men tended to be rather bony. You know, very few people were overweight. But then again, if you got up close, they might not have any teeth, or they'd have black teeth. And of course, the life expectancy was much lower. I think it was something in the late 40s, early 50s. Half the working class kids in York, where I'm from, I think, would have been walking around the town with bare feet. So I think the bottom line is it would have been a beautiful time to live if you were rich. The countryside was perfect, you know. There was an agricultural depression, therefore it was deserted. But it was also beautiful. Hedges, 10 foot tall, you know, you couldn't see over the hedges. In one of my novels, The Death on a Branch Line, that's all set in the countryside, people have long conversations standing in the middle of the road. And I wanted the reader to think, wait a minute, they're standing in the middle of the road, they're going to get run over in a minute. But no, they aren't, because there'd be one car through that village every day.
Now, were you a railwayist when you were young? Is that where this interest in the railways comes from?
My father worked on the railways all his life, and I had free first-class railway travel. So I spent a lot of time just dreaming on trains. If I was bored, I grew up in York, I'd just go to London, say, Dad, I'm off to London, and he wouldn't bat an eyelid. I'd come back on the 1 o'clock train, which always took about 3 or 4 hours. It was always way too hot or too cold. I'd stretch out flat in a first-class compartment, wake up, look out the window, there'd be some illuminated factory going past. You never really knew where you were, or just miles and miles of dark fields. I found it all very mentally stimulating. Odd characters would get in, big red-faced men in business suits, obviously half pissed. You know, they'd be a bit annoyed at seeing a kid sitting in first class, and I'd sometimes pretend to be asleep, but I'd be observing them. And I think half the plots of my novels came from those early days of travelling about on the railways. I also acted in the, or rather helped backstage in the York Railway Players, went on holiday with the British Railways Touring Club, parked my bike in the railway bike sheds, which were supposed to be only for railway men. You know, it's like being the aristocracy in York to have a dad who worked on the railways, because York was a real railway centre.
So you'd say you would be a romantic railway person rather than a hard-nosed one?
I was never one of the number-crunching train spotters. I could never really see the point of hanging about collecting numbers. I did a bit of that, but really I was only interested in the Deltics, which had names rather than numbers. The names of regiments or racehorses, I think it was. And so I went through a phase of spotting Deltics. Train spotters, I found rather overawed me, and they still do, in fact, by their technical mastery of the railways.
And are you trying to say things in the novels about the modern-day railway?
I think the whole point of writing historical novels generally is to say something about the modern day, because you're urging the reader always to compare the past with the present. But I'm trying to make points about the railways, certainly. My father worked on the railways in the 70s in finance in York, and he was always having to cut back, which was against his better instincts, because he was pro the railways. But it was always about retrenchment. And so I deliberately set my books on the Edwardian railways when the railways were booming, when they were at their peak, when the Bradshaw, which was the railway timetable of the period, was absolutely stuffed to bursting with train times and all sorts of complicated fiddly footnotes, like you'd find your train you wanted and then you'd see the footnote, you'd say, but not on Thursdays. Market days only. Change here for Loch Lomond steamer. And then all these adverts at the beginning for railway products and railway hotels. And it's a kind of revenge on behalf of my father, you know, to go back to a time when railways were taken seriously, when they were important, when they were beautiful, glamorous, all of which they can and I think will be again. But meanwhile, people can see how it was by looking at my books.
So glad there was a choo-choo on the end of that. If there had not been, I'd have sent it back to be redone.
Disappointing.
The country's only surviving Duke Dog engine getting away from Horsted Keynes on the Bluebell Railway in Sussex. And that was Andrew Martin talking to Howard Benson. And Andrew's latest Jim Stringer novel, The Last Train to Scarborough, is published by Faber. I have caught a train to Scarborough. It's a very pleasant place to go. The trains aren't terribly interesting now, though. Just small and a bit nondescript.
Yeah, and crowded.
And crowded, and they don't go choo-choo. Actually, they are very crowded. I go to York a lot, where I'm from, and they go, the trains from Scarborough are going, I presume, to the airport at Manchester, and they are dreadful. Have you got any train stories for me?